listeners. Welcome to Inside the Raven. I'm Laura Benson from Tenderfoot TV, and today I'm talking with sports journalist and host of this podcast, Tim Livingston. Consider this your backstage pass to take you inside the Raven to learn more about Tim's reinvestigation into the Atlanta Super Bowl murders. We'll hear all about his life before the show, what inspired the Raven, and why it's so personal for him. Now it's time to hear what it's like when the interviewer becomes interviewee. Let's go inside the Raven. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
I'm really excited to have this conversation with you today. I just binged the first three episodes of the show, and I'm really a fan. You got me. It is a super engaging story so far. Full disclosure, I'm not much of a sports fan, but you don't need to be. The story is really, really fascinating. I would love to know what kicked off this investigation for you. Like, why did you want to start the Raven?
I didn't want to investigate this crime.
Okay.
What happened was after Whistleblower, which I did with Tenderfoot TV as well. Mm-hmm. And if you haven't listened to, you should. Mm-hmm. After we concluded Whistleblower, a group of documentary filmmakers that I really respected approached me about doing an investigative documentary, basically exactly what we did for the podcast, in real time, unravel a story. And so I had a bunch of stories that I was interested in, mostly basketball related. And these filmmakers were really pushing the Ray Lewis story. I was very familiar with Ray Lewis and this crime, familiar as in anybody who follows sports know this is something Ray Lewis is known for.
Right.
And I think the percentage of people who believe he got away with murder is over 50%. I think it's a very high percentage of people think Ray got away with murder. So I wasn't that interested in this story. I just didn't have any connection to it. A white guy from Los Angeles, I didn't have any connection to Ray or the victims or anything. But then I started looking into it. And I realized that this double homicide in Atlanta had eerily similar circumstances to a crime that really affected my life a year afterwards. The same murder weapon, the same exact bizarre circumstances. And then all of a sudden, it just hit me. It was the universe telling me to start looking into this thing. And I still didn't fully commit. I started making calls connected with this, with the victim's brother, Handsome Lawler, in Akron, Ohio. And I went to Akron. And by the time I left Akron, I knew this was the next story, and I knew it was going to be big.
Mm. So really quickly, I have so many follow-up questions just from that. But before we get really into it, for people who maybe don't know the crime that we're talking about, can you give a really quick overview?
For sure. So Ray Lewis was the former middle linebacker of the Baltimore Ravens, considered by many the greatest middle linebacker in NFL history. He's an absolute legend on the field, a Hall of Famer, an MVP, a GOAT, as is the overused term now. So Ray Lewis, when he was, I believe, 24 years old, after a Super Bowl in Atlanta that he did not participate in, was involved in a fight outside of the Cobalt Lounge nightclub in Buckhead, and two men died in that fight. And for over two decades, there have been very few answers as to what actually happened in that fight. And so this podcast is an investigation into that crime and into the potential involvement of Ray Lewis.
That leads me to my next question, actually. Can you share why this case specifically is so engaging without giving too much away?
Ah, the challenge. I could give it all away and nobody would listen to the podcast. This case, there's this sweet spot in the sports world of things that happened a little over two decades ago that are crazy. And that because of the media and because of the media's relations with or relationships, the media relationship with sports leagues, because of those two things, because this was nascent internet and because the media of that time relied completely upon the sports leagues for access to cover the leagues, that was their income would be hugely affected if they actually did any sort of investigative reporting into a lot of these stories. So there is a sweet spot from like 1992 to 2002 where something like this that happened, there just aren't a lot of answers out there. And so if you Google Ray Lewis murder, if you Google anything relating to these crimes, there just aren't many answers. There are a few articles and a few news clippings. You can kind of piece together 30% of it, but there is 70% that we uncover in this podcast that is not, there's just no way you would know it as a member of the public. You don't have any sort of access to that information. So once we started every single interview, I feel like we did at the beginning, there was a revelation that felt pretty huge. And so this podcast is a culmination of all those interviews and all those revelations. We got lucky in a lot of things. You couldn't understand the district attorney's side of the story, the prosecution side of the story, unless you were able to get Clint Rucker or Paul Howard. And those two men were in office from, I believe, 1997 to 2020. I.e., they would never have talked to us while they were in office.
Right.
And luckily, I started this podcast in 2021, and Clint Rucker had just left. He was no longer a public servant. He could talk. Got incredibly lucky there. And that was the biggest revelation of the podcast, as you will hear in episode 4. So there was just a lot of, you know, the timing. Like if we tried to do this in 2018, this podcast probably would not have been as good. So we got lucky in a lot of ways. And in the end, there just isn't a lot out there right now. And there will be a lot more once this podcast finishes.
Right. Well, that points out a couple really interesting things to me. The first is that in the world that we're in now, we almost kind of take for granted the fact that the internet exists and there is all this independent journalism happening, but that wasn't the case back then. And that's really interesting about media and these major sports leagues being so connected. The other thing that really points out that's really interesting is how long the story spans. You know, and sometimes we look back and people might be thinking, well, why do I care about a story that happened almost 25 years ago? You know, why do we want to go back? And what you're saying, people couldn't talk, right? Folks who are still working, people who are still somehow connected in that industry, they can't actually share their information until they've left those places. So sometimes these things just take a lot of time to reveal themselves, which is super fascinating.
Yeah, 20 years later, there's a lot of FBI files coming out from the 50s and 60s right now that are really interesting and help you piece together some of the most important moments in history. And if you can understand those moments with renewed clarity, then it teaches you a lot about, in this case, I mean, we hope that our listeners learn something about themselves and how they deal with trauma and how they deal with things in life that just completely change your life in a split second. We hope that the listeners that there's takeaways there. We hope that there's takeaways with how they look at the justice system. And I know there's a lot of examples out there of crooked justice. I think this one is pretty grievous, and I hope that it causes everybody to look at systems in general and the justice system in a different light. There's a lot of really important things that you can learn from in stories like this that took place a long time ago where you get all this clarity and you uncover new information. And I think it also gives hope. I think it gives hope if somebody that you love or care about, if something happened to them and you've been craving answers and closure for 20 plus years, that you can still achieve that.
Well, that's a perfect segue to one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, which is, and you already alluded to this, is this experience that you had that really eerily actually mirrored the story that you were covering. Can you share about that experience? It comes up right at the beginning of the second episode, so I don't feel like it's too much of a spoiler.
No, I didn't feel drawn to the story until I realized the similarities with Deanna. When I was 15 years old, Deanna Moreno was my best friend. We went to a party in Westwood, which is like we were public school kids, but these were all private school kids. Westwood's an affluent area in LA, is a place where things like this do not often happen. She got into an argument as we were leaving the party, or a girl started arguing with her. Deanna was completely in the right. She had reprimanded her sister for being destructive. This girl confronted Deanna. she punched her one time. Deanna went to the ground. None of us saw a knife. Deanna was wearing a hoodie, so we didn't know she was stabbed. We thought the wind just got the wind knocked out of her. We were 15. We just didn't know anything. But it turned out she was stabbed directly in the heart. One stab, boom, gone. And the girl who did it ended up ODing that night.
Oh.
So the next morning, she was gone as well. So two deaths over nothing. And I think that's a big, like, that's the same as the Super Bowl murders story. These two, the two victims in that story, Richard Lawler and Jason Baker, why do they have to die? Why? There's no reason. And with Deanna, I guess at least we got closure. We knew who did it. And then, you know, that ended tragically as well, but it ended shortly thereafter. The victims in the Ray Lewis case, once I realized how little they knew and understood about this story, that became a really powerful part, just giving them this real clarity into what happened to their loved ones.
Wow. I'm a little bit wordless after that, but
heavy stuff. There isn't, when I tell people about this story, it's like whistleblower. There's a lot of great, you're at a party and you're talking about referees getting drunk, and there's a lot of levity in whistleblower. In this story, there's really not.
Right.
For the most part, there's a lot of sadness. We definitely try and get the light at the end. I think there is a lot of that in the closure element. But ultimately, this is just a really sad story on a lot of different levels. And don't want to depress the audience too much going into it, but it's a real true, it's a gritty, gritty story.
Want episodes of The Raven 1 week early and ad-free? Subscribe to Tenderfoot Plus on Apple Podcasts or on other platforms at tenderfootplus.com. We'll be right back after this break.
When you were in the process of working on it, you have one clip where you actually talk about trauma, and you get into, you have, I don't remember who it is who joins the show, you have a quote from a psychotherapist, I believe. You can correct me.
Stephen Porges. He's like the, we took this analogy, I had this analogy in at some, or this, at some point in my VO, I called him the LeBron James of mental health.
Amazing.
we took that out of respect to Dr. Porges, but he's a brilliant studier of the brain.
Incredible.
And there's a group of three or four doctors in the world that have really advanced how we treat trauma and just psychophysiological, you know, all that stuff that really advanced those studies. And Dr. Porges is one of them.
So was that something, did you engage with your own trauma and your own process differently in the process of doing this show? Like, was this cathartic for you as well?
Yeah, really cathartic. We get into this more in the end, but I think it's my reaction to Deanna's death is very common. Just became a turtle, right? Just went inside, buried that in the deepest recesses of my psyche, and just distracted myself with all the other things to move on and to live and survive. And that is, I think, again, a very common tactic in surviving something like that and getting over the hump mentally. But then you never heal. And I think what I hope really comes out of this is that to get through something terrible, you have to talk about it, and you have to do the work to heal. Same as if you tear your ACL, you have to do the rehab in order to get that knee back to 90%, and you have to do the same thing with your brain. And so that's something that intrinsic, I think most of us understand, but very rarely act upon. And so this podcast with Deanna, and, you know, I really lost touch with Deanna's family and her mom. And so this podcast brought me back closer to Deanna's mom in a really powerful way, and her family, and really her essence. And now I got two little girls at home. And so, you know, that means a lot. It means a lot just to have that connection with Deanna again.
That's really beautiful. Something that I really noticed in the show so far is that you seem really, it's a really great skill that you have of engaging folks in conversation. And like you're saying, you can't heal something if you don't talk about it. One person that you get to share who's never testified, there's another person who I won't give away again, but seems like you're not going to get, like, he's a stone-faced person. And then you kind of talk about how there's these little, you know, opening moments. And some people have these longer conversations with you that you don't even expect you're even going to get in the door of their house, right? So can you share a little bit about your approach to interviews and this vulnerability that you're bringing and how you're able to build trust with people so that they would open up to you about these things?
You know, when I graduated college, I wanted to be a TV writer, and I really just wanted to be locked into a room and left alone and just write. And then I realized at 25 that I needed to the word network became a thing. And I think it dawned on me that my EQ is pretty high and that that's a skill that I should probably utilize in life. And so I think I've always been able to relate to people and communicate with people and look people in the eye and convey that I really want to listen and I really want to understand them. And so I think that's a blessing and something that I have and have always had. And so I think with a lot of these characters, for whatever reason, I just feel really comfortable going into any situation and looking somebody in the eye and reading them. And if there's a soul in there, then I can usually connect to it. Mm. In this type of work with Tenderfoot TV, I've certainly dealt with people that I would say are on that sociopathic level and you can't relate to. Mm. That being said, most people I don't think fit that mold. I think most people are good. And so if they have an ounce of that in them, I've usually been pretty successful at creating some sort of quick trust and getting these stories. So I'm very grateful to have whatever that is. And certainly it's proven, I have that confidence now to meet somebody one time and tell them everything that I want to get out of whatever the conversation is, tell them genuinely what I want to do with it, and get them comfortable quickly.
Hmm. Do you ever have a sense of, you know, balancing maybe the story that you're really seeking from people and kind of where they're coming from in that moment? Like, have you ever rubbed up against a point where you feel like, oh, maybe I shouldn't keep pressing? And how do you handle that?
No, it's a really good question. I work in sports media.
Right.
And so I really dislike the gotcha journalism in general, and just when somebody sits down with you and there's supposed to be that trust between a reporter and a subject and the personalities who are just going to drive forever, I don't consider myself that person. I'd say I shy away and back off more quickly than most. I don't enjoy making people feel uncomfortable. When it comes to Jeff Gwynn, an important character in this podcast, episode 2, Jeff, I went in expecting to, and I did press him on certain details related to the case that I really wanted to understand, but I realized pretty quickly that that interview was going to have a different focus than I thought. Mm. That interview was going to be pure catharsis for him. That interview was going to be about what it is, what witnessing something like that means and does. And I really, that interview was the first big one that I did for the podcast, and it really helped shape a lot of the major themes that come out over the course of the podcast. So I think going into an interview with direction and with a plan and with a ton of research, but also being malleable, because there's just, I'd say like 28% of interviews, it's like, you know, at least one of four interviews goes a different direction, but it can be a really interesting direction. You just got to, whatever direction that is, you got to get everything you can out of it. And the content can be pretty good.
That's really interesting. Thank you for sharing. That's something that I think about a lot in these kinds of stories is, how are people getting people to just agree to have a microphone on while they're talking to them. That just kind of blows me away. And then they really, especially Jeff, that if you haven't listened to this episode yet, it is so incredibly touching. That conversation with his family chatting in the background very casually is just so engaging, and it's so vulnerable, and it's really beautiful. And it's very clear to me the fact that you have so much compassion and personal empathy and experience with this topic that the two of you are able to connect on a deeper level. And I'm, you know, I am very curious whether somebody else who approached him with the same exact set of questions asked by a different human would have had a completely different set of answers, you know? So thank you for sharing that.
No, my pleasure. With Jeff, it's the vibe too, right?
Right.
It's, we had, I really wanted to connect with specifically Handsome. There have only been a couple articles about Richard Lawler, one of the victims, and Handsome, his brother, was most often quoted in those articles. And it seemed like he was the one who was willing to talk about this for the on the family's behalf. Mm-hmm. And he was not easy to track down, but once I was able to bond with Handsome and again, just let him know, genuinely, I just want to figure out what happened to your brother. And we became friendly and allies to achieve that truth. And so having Jeff Gwynn, I think just being able to surround him and Zig in Akron with Handsome and with Aunt Cindy and with these characters who they have talked to hundreds of times and know well, I think that was really, really important too.
Yeah, absolutely. Were there other elements or themes throughout the investigation that you felt particularly personally connected to?
Once we got into the investigation, I feel pretty connected to all of it. I feel pretty connected to the Atlanta PD part of it, the legal part of it. It's all, I think, it all feels really important. And the major themes that take place after the murder, the societal themes, they affect all of us. And so investigating those and unraveling those and figuring out, seeing different personalities who weren't about the right things and learning about them and going deeper and deeper down those rabbit holes. Yeah, the societal themes were definitely hit a lot as we built out this case.
What was the most challenging aspect of making the show?
All of it. Making a podcast is hard. Piecing together all these different, there's a lot of pieces. I think the hardest part about making this show was being vulnerable. I've never artistically had to be as vulnerable as I was personally in this podcast. So all the other stuff is hard. Getting interviews, writing scripts, doing all the things that you have to do to make a show. But I think, I mean, with Deanna, I hadn't spent a lot of time in the past decade, maybe 15 years, thinking about Deanna. There was a time in my early 20s at some point when I realized that I wasn't thinking about her. Like, she had been on my mind every single day for 5-6 years. And I remember the moment where I was like, man, I haven't thought about Deanna in a couple weeks. Mm. And being really saddened, but also aware that that was healthy and inevitable. So Deanna was a really important part of my childhood, and I really hadn't revisited that trauma or revisited her or really honored her. And so I think the vulnerability aspect of this podcast and really having to look inside myself to understand all those things and let them out, that was probably the hardest.
Yeah. Well, we're glad that you did. And that actually leads me to a question that I meant to ask you earlier, which is that listeners of this podcast are used to hearing you interview other people. So how does it feel to have the tables turned a little bit and be the one that's interviewed?
I enjoy it.
Great.
I'm hoping there's just a lot of great information that can come out this way, stuff that doesn't work in the actual podcast, but that I would love for people to know if they're interested in the story, both about myself and about the story itself. So I enjoy this, and I hope Dan Patrick and Dan Levitard and everybody who interviewed me for Whistleblower we need your audiences. So have me on. I would love to talk about this story. Appreciate you guys.
We'll be right back after a quick break.
So The Raven isn't your first podcast, and it's not your first podcast about crimes in sports. In 2021, you hosted Whistleblower, also with Tenderfoot, which you mentioned. Can you share what first motivated you to build that show and how you got into podcasting in the first place?
I got into podcasting because I couldn't make it in TV.
Ha!
I discovered podcasting the way many people did. I listened to Serial in 2015 or 16 and thought that the production of that story was fantastic.
Yep.
And at that point, I think 2012 was when I wrote an article, 2010, geez. So 5 years before, I had been extremely interested in the Tim Donaghy story for a long time and had connected with him through an article I wrote and thought there was, as a basketball fan, thought that the league, I thought the conspiracy around league referees and them potentially not having the game's integrity as the only thing on their mind when refereeing, I thought that was a story, and I just couldn't believe that anybody wasn't interested in it. And so I pursued that story for a long, long time. But in 2015, I listened to Serial, and I'd also gleaned enough knowledge about Hollywood at that point and about that city's appetite at the time for making controversial stories. Again, this goes into like a larger media discussion around the fact that ESPN could never make the Donaghy story because they had a multi-billion dollar partnership with the NBA, and they were producing the most sports documentaries this time. I just understood enough about the business to know that a sports documentary on Tim Donaghy was a long shot. And listened to Serial, and I was like, oh, this is it. This is how you tell that story. This is how you break down every single fascinating detail of it. And so with Whistleblower, it was really having that first introduction to Donaghy, going down the rabbit holes that he took me down, listening to the stories of other NBA refs and the culture of NBA refereeing, and understanding as a basketball fan how that affected hundreds, if not thousands, of players and millions of fans, and why that would be important to a lot of people. And then understanding that this, now learning in 2015-ish that this medium existed, and that it'll be the perfect medium to tell that story.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really great that you found that. Was there somebody in your personal life that suggested it to you? Was it something that you just listened to Serial and you were like, I'm going to try this? Like, how did you find the resources to actually build a podcast, right? Because it was one thing to listen to a show that's really engaging, know that that's the medium. And then another thing to actually be the person that decides, I'm going to do this now. How did you get to that point?
I was not the original host of Whistleblower.
Okay.
We had a couple of different iterations of the project. There was a journalist based out of New York who had followed this story very closely. And so originally, I definitely knew that I had a story within the story, that my relationship with Donaghy was unique, that there was points where I was like, am I the host? Am I not? But I was originally not supposed to be the host. This journalist had a lot of information that I, at that point, didn't have. And so she was supposed to be the host of Whistleblower. And that fell through. I met Donald Albright through Orrin Rosenbaum at UTA. And I pitched Donald Albright is the president of Tenderfoot. I pitched him a story on Gilbert Arenas and Javaris Crittenden, the guns in the locker room scandal, which is a fascinating NBA scandal as well. I pitched him that. It fell apart. But right as it fell apart, I got a call from Tim Donaghy saying that he was willing to do a podcast.
Wow.
And I knew I really wanted to work with Donald and with Tenderfoot. And I called Donald and I said, hey, man. Sorry, that first one, can we do this? And Donald gave me the platform. He said, yeah, he took a chance. Like I had never hosted a podcast, never put together a 10 episode investigative podcast. Donald gave me the opportunity to do it. And I think it turned out well for all of us.
Yeah, I would say so.
except David Stern, but he's gone.
So what did you learn from The Whistleblower that helped you in this journey of producing The Raven?
I learned everything. Yeah. I learned at the beginning, I was kind of freestyling my voiceover. I'm sure Donald will laugh remembering this, but he was like, dude, you have to actually write the script. You can't just like wing it like this. You have to write a script and the audience needs to think that you're smart. So I knew nothing about making this type of podcast at the beginning of Whistleblower. And by the end, I felt really comfortable. I felt comfortable with how to lay out this type of story with the audio components, with the music components that I really didn't know anything or understand. It also helps to have hugely talented people, Alex Vespisted and Mavs, who does all of our music at Tenderfoot. So I had really talented people that helped. But by the end of Whistleblower, I felt really, really confident. And I felt like I can do this again if the opportunity arises. And so I've pursued a lot of different stories, but the Ray Lewis story is the one that just worked. Some I'm still pursuing, but just haven't been able to get to that point where, oh wow, we have new evidence. Oh wow, we have more new evidence. Oh wow, this thing feels big. This thing feels like something that hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of people might want to learn about.
Right, absolutely. And yeah, you just alluded to it. There is a lot of new information in The Raven that hasn't reached people, but what can we expect from the rest of the season?
What you can expect is to understand everything that happened in those 30 seconds on that street in Buckhead in a really profound and powerful way. And again, if you start Googling right now and you really spend the rest of your day trying to learn about this based on what's available publicly, you're not going to get that far. When I talk about this story, when I talk about where we get to it, that's what's exciting. I love Serial, but my big qualm with Serial and with other podcasts like that, again, it's brilliant. I don't want to shit on Serial, but my big qualm is that there's a lot of great investigative podcasts where you get to the end and you don't have real answers. Mm-hmm. And so with this one, we get real answers. And I think those answers are really fascinating. They're not simple. It isn't just like Ray Lewis did this, right? It's Ray Lewis got caught up in a very complex web with a lot of moving parts, and how he escaped that web is fascinating. And whether he should have been in that web at all is certainly an important question. So I'm excited for listeners to get to the end and have more questions. There's still going to be really good questions, but I think there's going to be overwhelming clarity on what transpired that night. And I hope, again, that just gives anybody who was involved in this, especially from the victim side, that true closure.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you also mentioned, and something that I've been gathering so far in the first few episodes, is all of the different layers that factor into what you're saying, the convolution of the story and why it still hasn't been publicly known what actually happened in those 30 seconds so quickly. So that to me is something that's been really interesting, is all of these unexpected turns that you start taking of, okay, well, why didn't we actually know the truth?
Why didn't we know the truth? Who was sabotaging the truth, Laura?
Dun, dun, dun.
That is an important question. And of course, what is the truth? I think the next step with this story is for Ray Lewis to address it. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I think people are really going to want to hear his side of the story. I think that Ray, I have this experience from Tim Donaghy, where I felt like at the end of Whistleblower, Donaghy should feel vindication. I thought we vindicated him in a lot of ways. Tim Donaghy did not feel that way. Tim Donaghy has not spoken to me since Whistleblower. He was very angry at how he was portrayed. And with Ray, I'm just interested to see how he reacts, because I feel like there's a perception of him right now within America's football-loving society that outside of Baltimore is not that positive. And I think we get to the end and you understand a lot more about Ray, and you understand a lot more about his character. And I think for the most part, it's not all flattering, but I think for the most part, this is vindicating for Ray Lewis. And so I'm really eager for people to get to the end and formulate their opinion. Tell me why I'm an idiot and full of shit. Tell me whatever they think. Because there's, again, it's just that beautiful balance of clarity, but with a lot of questions, specifically ones that can only be answered by the man in the middle.
Yeah. I'm also really curious about Ray Lewis's persona in the press in the first few episodes, we've only heard a few clips from Ray himself, and it seems like he's mostly talking about divine timing and kind of depersonalizing a bit. What do you think reflects the real Ray Lewis? Do you think he's using faith as a defense, or has he not actually spoken out about much of this, or is it just that you're peppering things in slowly and we're going to hear more from him later on?
It's a great question. I think, without giving too much away, there were somebody worked behind the scenes to make a lot of potential trial related, I'm using, being so careful with words here, potential trial related issues for Ray Lewis. There were several at the beginning that weren't there at the end. And there was allegedly a group that worked to make some of those problems either disappear or become less problematic. And so I think it's interesting with Ray all these years later, whether he could speak openly about that now that some people that may or may not have been involved in making those problems go away are no longer here. For me, when it comes to Ray Lewis and those problems, I think, I don't know. I mean, I'd just love to hear why. I mean, I think there's a version of the story where you listen to Ray Lewis talk about some of these things and nod your head a lot. But again, I gotta hear from Ray. When it comes to Ray's media portrayal, his default is to go high and to go to his higher power because there are things that he couldn't have talked about in the past that I think he can talk about now. Mm. I think 20 years later that the things that he can talk about, I hope that there are more things that he can talk about that can provide a really genuine reflection of his experience. I'd be fascinated to hear him. I really hope we can, because I do think he's hiding things and I do think he deflects, but I also understand why.
Right. So his career didn't really pause at all when this happened. It actually took off immediately after his team won the Super Bowl. He got 2 like MVP awards. Do you think that he actually, in certain ways, became more famous or maybe almost even gained more respect or fear from people because of all of this press coverage right at the beginning?
Definitely more respect and fear on the football field.
Ah, yeah.
I mean, he scared you on more than one level. Most people, again, think that he is a murderer. And so when you're playing a game where reckless abandon is everything, where violence is your vocation, then I think that definitely helped him on the football field. That being said, I think he's such a special talent. He would have ended up being the greatest middle linebacker no matter what. So I do think there's an element where he now has this legend where he got away with murder. And I think that did affect him positively in some ways, but I know it affected him negatively. I know he's had this there's been a cloud hanging over him for 24 years.
Right.
And I hope for Ray, it would be cathartic for him as well to address this and to answer some tough questions about what happened that night, because ultimately, I don't think hopefully after all this truth comes out, he doesn't need to hide anymore.
Thank you so much for listening. And I think I speak for all of us when I say thank you to Tim for giving us the inside track on The Raven. If you have questions for Tim, drop us a comment on Instagram @TheRavenPod or @Tenderfoot.tv.